You're listening to Central Time. It's 4:06. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, two unique museums here in the state telling the stories of gas stations and accordions.
First, two Republican state lawmakers are proposing that some underperforming Milwaukee public schools be turned over to charter and voucher school operators. Those lawmakers are Representative Dale Coinga and Senator Alberta Darling, both from the Milwaukee suburbs.
Under the plan, the Milwaukee County Executive would oversee the turnover of up to five struggling Milwaukee public schools per year. Here with us to give us the details is Aaron Richards, education reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Aaron, good to have you back.
Hello.
So what's the argument from these lawmakers for turning over the operation of these underperforming public schools to charter or voucher schools?
Alberta Darling and Dale Coinga say there have been decades of underperformance in Milwaukee and that there hasn't been enough done to try something different at schools that have chronically underperformed. It's a tough way to, you don't really want to say they're failing schools. These schools are the schools that have gotten failing grades on their state report cards, but for the most part, these are very high poverty schools that serve almost all children of color, and they are located in very difficult neighborhoods. Despite that, these lawmakers say there hasn't been enough done and that this is something new that hasn't been tried before that could really spark some change because the management of the school could be different and the schools would not have to go through the school board to make changes.
So from what we know from these lawmakers so far, how would this work in practice if it were to pass as is?
Sure. At the top of the chain would be the county executive who would appoint a commissioner to oversee these schools. It would start with a small number of schools. The eligible pool would be the 55 schools in MPS that have received failing grades on their report cards or the fails to meet expectations rating. The commissioner would choose up to three schools in the first year of this program, and after that could add up to five schools a year to get some kind of different treatment. There's actually three different kinds of treatment the school could receive. It could be run directly by the commissioner. It could be run by a charter school or even a private voucher school that puts in a proposal to run the program.
So this sounds really different from anything I've heard before, because usually when you think of a charter or a voucher, it's side by side. It's existing in the same community as a public school. And this, it sounds like to me, if you live in this community, you don't have that public school option anymore. You'd take the school that's now run by a charter or voucher.
Well, in Milwaukee, there's an immense amount of choice for parents to attend the school that they would like to go to. You can go to a traditional public school. You can, if you meet the income requirements, you can go to a private school on a publicly funded voucher, or you can go to a charter school, which are public schools. This would be giving more opportunity for different management companies to run those a select number of those low-performing schools, or if it was run directly by the commissioner, it would mean that any changes wouldn't have to go through the school board, which is a big sticking point, especially for the union that sees the school board as being the democratically elected, sort of board that oversees your public schools. So there's a question of, is this a plan to simply privatize more schools in Milwaukee, or is it meant to try something radically different in hopes of getting change of some kind for these schools?
Talking to Aaron Richards, education reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about a proposal from Republican state lawmakers to, in effect, turn some Milwaukee schools that are currently public schools into charter or voucher schools, or schools run by charter or voucher providers. So are these lawmakers, Aaron, looking to other states for examples, for precedent, and what are they seeing when they look out there?
There are some models out there already. Tennessee has schools that are put into a turnaround zone. Probably the largest example we have is in Louisiana, where virtually all the public schools were turned into charter schools after Hurricane Katrina because so many of the staff were let go, and then these young, sort of charter companies came in. And that city is virtually a city of all charter schools that are public, and they all have their individual school boards, but there's very little, of the old model left, where you have a large number of schools that all answer to a single board. Detroit has schools in a similar type of turnaround zone. So far, the research shows that the results are pretty mixed. In some cases, the schools are doing better than they were before, but it has not, even in these other states, been an immediate sort of cure-all. Alberta Darling has said she'd like to see these schools be improving in 2 to 5 years after they get put into this opportunity zone, as they're calling it, in Milwaukee. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of research out there that shows it's not necessarily going to turn around that fast, if it turns around at all.
You mentioned one objection from the unions being that this would take away power from the elected school board. Another objection that's been raised is these schools could be run by a religious voucher organizations. Has that been a problem for some?
You know, this is part of the proposal that may actually hit a legal challenge. As the basis for their proposal, Alberta Darling's office provided a provision in state statute that says that public schools are actually able to partner with private schools, but those private schools would have to be non-sectarian. So they're relying on that as the basis for this proposal, but it's pretty clear there would be a difference between partnering with a non-sectarian private school, as state statute allows right now, and allowing a private school that teaches religion to take over a public school. I don't think we've seen that anywhere else in the country, and I think there's still a question of whether that's going to be a legal issue. If it is, Darling has said that they would simply drop the, they would make it clear that if you were a voucher school and you took over this public school, that you would not be able to teach religion.
Now, turning to the people who work at these schools currently, what would happen with the teachers and support staff at a school under this procedure if it got turned from public school into voucher or charter hands?
According to the plan, teachers and staff would have to reapply for their job. And if they wanted to stay, they would waive the right to be represented by a union. It's also a little fuzzy, but it doesn't look like you'd have to have a full state teaching license to be a teacher at these schools. There is precedent for that. That in voucher schools right now, you don't have to have a state teaching license. You do have to have a bachelor's degree, according to state law. But in these new schools, it looks like there would be some kind of special license you could get if you didn't already have a state teaching license. But they call it non-portable, so I'm thinking maybe that's only for you to teach in one of these schools, getting this special treatment. But essentially, the staff would have to have a pretty, different change from what they have now if they're part of the union. I'm assuming they would be put on one-year contracts, and the schools would be run a little bit more like businesses and a little bit less like traditional public schools.
Now, you've mentioned the Milwaukee Teachers Union not wild about this plan. What are you hearing, if anything, from other stakeholders in the area about this proposal?
Well, at the moment, we're waiting to see what the county executive's office thinks of this. The county, I got a call from some county board members who said they didn't know it was coming, but that's not too surprising, although I think that we'd like to hear what the county executive thinks of this. And everyone else has been fairly open-minded. If this goes through, it would probably have to be tied up by the end of this month. So I think there's going to be a couple of days here where a lot of people chime into the discussion and can talk about what they, the lawmakers are seeking feedback, and people have, a couple of key weeks here to provide it.
All right, Erin, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Erin Richards, education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a proposal from Republican lawmakers that underperforming Milwaukee schools would be turned over to charter and voucher school operators. Continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org.
And we keep the museum tour going right now and visit A World of Accordions. It features over 1,300 accordions and related instruments and houses exhibits devoted to musicians and bands, which feature the accordion.
Helmy Harrington is the owner and curator of A World of Accordions in Superior. Helmy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for allowing me to be part of this program.
Well, what will we see when we walk into the World of Accordions Museum?
Well, first, you should know that we're not only a local, but also a national and, in many ways, a world treasure. We are the single best accordion museum collection of instruments and their taxonomy in history anywhere. But you will see a breathtaking, eye-appeal, candy-like selection of 1,300 accordions on display. There are more in the building for varying displays, but you'll see all kinds of colors and designs, many more types of keyboard structures than anybody presumes as part of the family.
You mentioned the taxonomy. How much variety is there in the way accordions are designed and put together?
They were invented in 1829 by patent of Cyril Damian in Vienna. The instrument spread like wildfire throughout the world, and every country and every small place redesigned them to suit their own musical needs. So there are hundreds and hundreds of variations. No one has yet put together a complete taxonomy, and I've personally been working on one for 20 years, and it's still not complete.
Wow. And you've also got exhibits and tributes to a number of accordionists and bands that feature the accordion. Can you tell us about a couple of them?
Absolutely. Well, here, the accordion is always popular throughout the world. It's one of the main distributors of folk music, legends, texts, body rhythms, dances, and traditions everywhere. So we have folk interests that are particularly strong since the 1980s, in which there was a rejuvenation of nostalgia throughout the United States. We have lots of pop music that results through and from that, so garage accordionists or garage bands add an accordion or a concertina, at least to the 75% of all, I am told. There are lots of rock and roll or pop bands that use them for periodic sound effects, and of course the instrument is a concert instrument, so there are a number of not only entertainment and virtuoso groups, but very serious artistic performers that deal with the original repertory of the instrument, which is every bit as important to the world as Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms.
It's a really versatile instrument. It's kind of like a guitar in a way that it's portable, it can be a solo accompaniment to somebody singing, and it works really well with a band, too.
Well, this is true.
Now, tell us a little more about the museum. How long have you been there?
We have a museum was established about 25 years ago. We were first in Duluth, and we've been in Superior, Wisconsin for the last 12-plus years. The museum comprises not only the collection of accordions, but also a fabulous concert hall in which they are sounded and which has attracted performers from all over the world. We have library rooms that deal with reference materials and constructions of the instrument's history. We have about 1 million pieces of music that are accordion-related. For all of the members of the accordion family, we have catalogs, we have historic descriptions, we have reference materials, and we have the American Accordionist Association's archival collection, so that there is a presence in our building where people can view the social history of this major organization. Wow. We also have the Defner Legacy. We have some very specialized collections, right?
So you mentioned that you get musicians from all over the world. You also get researchers coming in to check out all those materials.
Thank you for asking. Yes, we've had at least 24 worldwide. We get national people and about 24 books or DVD documentaries have resulted from at least part of the studies that take place here.
Now, you are obviously someone who loves the accordion. What led you to that?
My mother and I emigrated from Germany after World War II, and it was how my mother made a living for us in Texas. She studied at the world's best accordion school and then made a living for our small family in Texas. I was interested in what she did, so even as a small child, was influenced by the accordion. I used the accordion to support myself all the way through 14 years of college. But by the time I was a teenager, my eyes went to a different direction, and I became a concert pianist, after which, well, in addition to which, I earned a PhD in musicology. So nowadays, people don't argue too much about truth in references, but certainly the passion for music has been part of my life. And the knowledge of good and bad is present in that. Certainly also the love of making the music, which has spurred everything I've ever done.
With all the time you put into the museum, do you still have time to play and perform and teach music?
I have about 60 students a week.
Really? Wow.
In two locations, 200 miles apart. I play regularly in concerts and have done so with the symphony as well as in my own private environment here and elsewhere, as well as in national venues. So, yes, the love of making the music is what spurs and keeps it alive in my heart.
And if we visit World of Accordions, would we be able to talk you into doing a performance in the in your music hall there?
Oh, I wish you would. Yes, put me to the test. You see, I play all of the members of the accordion family, and so when I put on a demonstration, I'll play that which is folk, virtuoso, specific ethnic, like French musettes, as well as concert material and the transcriptions from the classics like Bach fugues or original music that was written for the accordion. Yes, I do all of it.
How important is the accordion as part of our cultural heritage here in Wisconsin in particular?
I think Wisconsin has a special basis for love in the instrument. We have many great performers that have established their lifespans here. I mean, Frankie Yankovic is certainly one. We have so many specific ethnic groups that have loved and promoted the accordion. I think we're in a very fortuitous place. But also, Wisconsin is in the center of the nation. There is no more perfect place to have some activity or important interest like we have for the accordion.
I've seen, it seems like, more and more people getting into accordions or the accordion family. I know my brother has picked up the concertina recently. Are we in the midst of an accordion renaissance?
Well, I'd like to say that there has never been a major decline because, you see, I've been in the accordion studio and business activities all my life, and it's always been big and important in my world. But I do think that there's truth to that. There are more people buying more instruments, more companies coming into existence, more distribution issues that seem to go not only nationwide but worldwide.
Helmy,
so the groundswell is there again.
Helmy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ferret. I love the opportunity.
That was Helmy Harrington, owner of a World of Accordions Museum in Superior. This is Central Time.
In recent weeks, there's been a slew of announcements from big food companies and restaurant chains, not about what's being added to their products and menus, but what's being taken out. Panera is pulling a laundry list of artificial ingredients, sweeteners, and colors. Pepsi is dropping aspartame from its flagship diet soda, and Kraft is removing preservatives and synthetic colors from its mac and cheese.
It doesn't end there. Tyson Foods plans to remove antibiotics used in humans from the production of chickens, and burrito chain Chipotle is removing many genetically modified ingredients from its menu. So what's driving all these changes, and how will this ultimately affect you as a consumer and when you go out to eat?
Joining us now is Michael Moss. He's an investigative reporter with the New York Times and author of the book Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hello, glad to be with you.
Well, so in the last few weeks, major announcements from major food companies and restaurant chains regarding the removal of all kinds of things. I guess the big question, why are we seeing so much action right now?
You know, it's an incredibly wild spring out there with both groceries and restaurant food, but I think you really have to go back to early this year when one after another of the food giants reported, you know, abysmal profit earnings to their investors. And you had things like the CEO of Campbell Soup sort of conceding rather that we have lost the trust of our consumers or losing the trust, and we're not producing healthy food fast enough for people who are increasingly caring about what they put in their bodies. And I think that's what we're seeing, is that finally sort of that caring, and it's not just on the East Coast and the West Coast, it's in the heartland of the U.S., is being translated into purchase decisions, and all of these companies, whether big restaurant chains or grocery manufacturers, are really sensitive to drops in sales. The slightest sort of revenue loss will send them scrambling to figure out a way to respond.
So would you say that this is being driven by a good faith effort to make food healthier for the American public, or is this, you know, hey, we're losing money, let's do something quickly?
You know, I've never seen the processed food industry as this kind of evil empire that intentionally set out to make us overweight or otherwise ill, but by the same token, I don't see them as philanthropies that are going to start getting all, you know, non-profit on us. I mean, these are companies doing what all companies want to do, which is to make as much money as possible by selling as much stuff as possible. And you know, and if they can sell healthy stuff and make money, they're happy. Because the other, you know, by the same token, within these, even the biggest food giants, there are these cabals of insiders who've been pushing for years to get their own companies to do better by people's health. And I think we're finally sort of starting to see that kick in a big way. But only because consumers are putting pressure on them through their purchase decisions.
So when you look back at the history of the food industry, have you ever seen a time when consumers seem to have so much power?
Kind of. You know, and in fact, if you kind of look back at the 80s, you know, people were really concerned about sugar back then, and you saw a lot of sort of diet, you know, low-calorie, artificial sweetener stuff come along. And then the 90s was kind of a low-fat era, concern about saturated fat, and you saw a lot of low-fat products come onto the market. And more recently, sort of salt is a concern, sort of as the people age, and sodium's connection to heart disease becomes a concern. And you know, it's fascinating about the sort of packaged food world. They're really good at responding to sort of one concern, right? They can lower the sugar by simply adding more fat and salt in, right, and keeping the product just as irresistibly tasty, or the, you know, they'll lower the salt by adding more sugar and fat or tinkering with it somehow. What's more difficult for them, though, is to sort of across the board improve the health profile of their stuff. That's really difficult, and that's what they're facing now.
So let's look at some of the stuff that's being phased out. Seems like there are sort of two strands here. One is chemicals, artificial ingredients, and another is GMOs.
Right.
Who's taking what out?
And not to forget sort of antibiotics in meat.
Right.
You know, and there's a couple categories of things. I mean, look, I focused on salt, sugar, fat in my report because talking to sort of the smartest nutrition scientists I knew, they said that, look, you know, when you talk about public health, that's the biggest stuff when you ask us what's causing obesity, what's driving diabetes, et cetera. But then there are all these 5,000 other additives in processed food, some of which are really innocuous, but you know, others of which are scary sounding and, you know, potentially sort of harmful in large amounts. And I think some of the artificial sweeteners fall in the latter category. Some of the food dyes we've seen Kraft respond to consumer concerns about the dye in macaroni and cheese, deciding to sort of take that out. You know, reputable scientists are saying, yeah, there's starting to be some pretty good evidence that could be a problem for people. So there's that category of thing. You know, GMOs and it's entirely different sort of boat. And I, you know, I'm on the fence on GMOs. I have to say, I'm not at the point where I shop for a product based on whether it has GMO in it, well, or not, as the case may be. But I hear the concern of people who say, look, this is not just about health concerns with GMO. This is about GMO kind of speaks to an industrial way of farming that may be out of sync with what we need today in terms of concerns about pesticides in the environment and et cetera, et cetera. So So GMO is a tough one, and it kind of depends just where you come down. But companies have begun, as you mentioned, you know, deciding that there's enough public concern out there about GMO that they're going to start taking, shifting rather their ingredient chain over to non-GMO products. Chipotle was the most recent one. And look, it's difficult for them. I mean, as I recall, they're working on getting Chipotle out of their, you know, solid food products, but not the drinks that they serve in the restaurant, which are, you know, which are typically field corn, high fructose corn syrup based, etc.
Talking right now to author Michael Moss about some of the latest food industry trends, from Chipotle dropping GMOs, Tyson phasing out certain antibiotics, and Panera dropping a big list of ingredients, artificial things and chemicals going into some of Panera's food that are being phased out. So is this a win for consumers in terms of health, if consumers want to be healthier? I mean, is there science that if we take... to take Panera, some of these artificial ingredients out, that we will, in fact, be healthier?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, you got to love some of these artificial ingredients, right? I mean, it's, you know, some of the, you know, these are the chemicals that food engineers use to sort of make processed food, keep the oil from separating, or the liquid from foaming up, or the off notes from being evident when you sort of taste them. And these are some of the miracle ingredients of processed food. So you're going to lose a little bit. And I was on a television show the other morning where one of the people said, look, I like my mozzarella white, and Panera is telling me that without this chemical, it's going to be sort of off color, if not brown. And yeah, there's going to be a little bit of trade-off in that regard. But I think it's all good. I mean, I think, look, people are paying attention to food. They're thinking about it. We're going to go overboard, no doubt, in some directions. And, you know, entirely new stuff is going to come along. I mean, look at the hit that almonds are taking due to the drought in California right now. I mean, boy, if there's a miracle food, it's the almond in terms of health and diet and satiety and keeping you from overeating, et cetera, et cetera. But boy, they use a lot of water. And so depending on what your framework is on food, whether it's water consumption or eat local or organic, or if you just plain just care about taste, which frankly a lot of us do, you're going to be looking at food in a different way, and there's going to be some conflict over what you think a good quote-unquote product looks like.
Now, looking at GMOs with Chipotle again, phasing some GMOs out, there are some who say that this is an anti-science move. Some people are pointing out, well, yes, the GMOs will be gone, but they'll be upping their use of insecticides and pesticides instead of yep, using insect-resistant corn. So where's the trade-off there?
I think those are really good arguments. And one thing that people sort of point out in that category, too, is that one of the really misleading words out there in processed food land is the word natural. It's entirely meaningless from a regulatory standpoint, but it's a really deep, emotionally powerful word. And so you're seeing it on the front of more and more packages touting themselves as natural, quote unquote. By contrast, you know, organic does and should mean that product was made using less, not entirely none, pesticides. And that's a big, important issue to people. So, in fact, if Chipotle was moving from, you know, a GMO type of oil, for instance, to one that's using substantial amounts of pesticides, I'm sure that's something that they're probably going to look at. And look, again, that sort of comes back to the food chain is really complicated. Almost nothing we eat or drink, including water, doesn't sort of have some impact someplace. And it's kind of like trying to figure out, like, how do you invest in a good socially conscious stock in the stock market, right? And you can drive yourself a little bit crazy thinking of all the factors you want going into a good, you know, buying into a company that you think is doing good by its workers, by the environment, by its profits, etc. And a little bit of that sort of plays out, a lot of that plays out in the food chain as well.
Well, we're talking right now to author Michael Moss. Some food trends we're watching right now: Chipotle dropping GMOs, Tyson phasing out certain antibiotics in chicken production, and Panera dropping some chemicals. A lot more there, too.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about these moves, with Kraft dropping preservatives and synthetic colors? Does that make you more likely to eat their mac and cheese? How important is it for you to know what's in your food? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Michael Moss. He's the author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, about the latest food industry news, mainly that major companies have announced moves away from artificial ingredients and, in some cases, antibiotics and genetically modified ingredients. You can join the conversation with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Michael, let's talk a little bit about Tyson now, getting rid of some antibiotics in its chicken production. Tyson, a huge chicken operation. What does this signal to you?
You know, I was really surprised by that on one hand. It's the signal there, I think, is sort of dual. It's people caring about animal welfare, right? The sort of the way that animals are treated, those animals, farm animals that we then eat. And two, kind of realizing that, you know, the meat industry appears to have gone way too overboard using, you know, human antibiotics, and there seem to be, you know, really strong possibility it's going to have big ramifications, or is having big ramifications on public health. And see that they're, you know, that they're not necessary. And that's the thing about a lot of these ingredients. I was looking at the, you know, the Panera Bread restaurant chain's kind of no-no list. And a lot of those things, they can easily switch over, you know, to something else, to, you know, that's probably much less riskier and or, you know, natural and benign or what have you. I think that the processed food industry generally, whether it's chicken producers or beef producers or just your average packaged food stuff, I think that they just sort of, you know, became enamored of their ability to engineer in the laboratory, to sort of create and manipulate ingredients to do these just wow, jazzy things, and they lost touch kind of with what people really want when they eat food, which is like real stuff that tastes great, but it's also healthy for you.
What is the science behind getting antibiotics out of food?
The science?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the concern is that the overuse of antibiotics can cause a lowering of resistance to disease, or rather, you know, it causes people to be less responsive to antibiotics when they get sick. I mean, that's one of the biggest concerns. And so the overuse of antibiotics, you know, can filtrate into the soil, into the water systems, and affect kind of the whole ecology of that. I think that's probably the biggest concern, is that usage that I've heard anyway and bought into.
Well, go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. As we talk with Michael Moss about some food giants making big changes to their products, including getting rid of GMOs in Chipotle's case, artificial ingredients at Panera, and antibiotics at Tyson. We go now to Sandy in Algoma. Sandy, hi.
Hi. I was just mentioning that about my family, probably about 90% of what we eat is organic. I buy very little processed foods. As far as I can tell, nothing is going to change unless it changes from the ground up, and that's kind of what I'm seeing happening. I think what Chipotle has done is fantastic, and I think that other restaurants will follow suit when they see just how popular that is. We go out of our way to go to Chipotle just because of their social and environmental responsibility.
All right. Thank you for that. And Sandy says things got to change from the ground up. Is that what's happening in effect?
Yeah, and that's really evident of sort of the view I think that a lot of people have. I mean, and one thing to sort of point out, though, I mean, if your concern is sort of overeating and weight gain and the significant weight gain that the USF has, I mean, it's one thing to sort of lower the bad boy ingredients in processed foods like salt, sugar, fat, and some of these 5,000 sort of food processing additives, etc. But it's an entirely another thing to sort of think about, how do you get more good stuff into that packaged food? And by good stuff, I mean fruits and vegetables. Because when you ask every smart nutritionist out there, they will say to you first, you know, I'm not worried about salt, sugar, and fat necessarily. I'm worried about how most of us are eating half as many vegetables as we should be during the day for better health. And so, you know, you go to a company like Nestle that's making the Hot Pocket microwavable sandwich brand that one, you know, could arguably, you know, point out as one of the poster boys for the obesity crisis. You know, hats off to Nestle sort of pulling back on the amounts of salt, sugar, fat in their product. But you know, the bigger question going forward is, how do you stuff that thing full of, you know, Brussels sprouts and broccoli and the good stuff that we need to be eating more of without ruining the health profile of those vegetables?
So do you think consumers have been fixated on the wrong things, in effect, based on what you're saying there, that sure, Chipotle is getting rid of GMOs, but maybe they should be thinking more about how to get more veggies in and how not to serve people, you know, 1,500 calorie burritos?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an increment. I mean, certainly in our house, look, we're not about processed foods. I've got two boys, 11 and 15, who are starting to cook now. You know, we're, and cook now, I think, is really key with a lot of this stuff. And I think that, you know, the next step to paying more attention to what's in packaged foods is to ask yourself, you know, do I really need to buy this jar of pasta sauce that can have the equivalent of a couple of Oreo cookies worth of sugar in it when I can easily just buy a can of whole tomatoes and a little bit of olive oil and some garlic and whatever herbs are lying around the kitchen and 5 minutes of time make an incredible homemade pasta sauce and sort of debunk this myth of convenience in processed foods? I think the more cooking we're able to do in our lives, the better off we're all going to be.
Now, some analysts have suggested that we're seeing these shifts because we could be in for really huge seismic changes in who's making our food and what's in it, and that these restaurant giants, these food production giants, could be really vulnerable for disruptors to swoop in and change everything. Do you see that potential?
Oh, absolutely. Silicon Valley right now, and sort of startup companies staffed by, you know, the same geniuses who, as you say, disrupted the tech world, are looking at the entire sort of food system in the U.S. like they looked at the telecom industry way back in the 1970s and going, like, we shouldn't be taking anything for granted, whether it's farming or transport or warehousing or the way that groceries get sold and delivered or the way that your refrigerator keeps track of the freshness of that broccoli. All of that stuff is up for change right now. And it's these small companies that really know how to innovate. One of the surprising things to me in my research is how risk averse the food giants are. They don't want to take any chances, and that's why you see so little innovation on their part. They're going to be looking to these small startups for fresh, bright ideas that they can then buy and co-opt, and I shouldn't say co-opt, buy and incorporate into their companies or not, and face the threat of.
So do you see this trend making some of these big food companies making more conscious decisions and also having a conscience in order to survive?
I do, absolutely. It's consumer driven. It's consumer sort of consciousness driven. And what I really like about it is that it's, you know, it's happening within the confines of our capitalist system. This is not coming from any government entity forcing these companies to start doing the right thing by people's health. They're responding to changes in the marketplace, which is an incredibly powerful apolitical force. And a lasting one, I think, much more than sort of government rules and regulations, which maybe doesn't, you know, doesn't rule those out entirely with a nod to the soda tax that passed recently out in Berkeley. But still, by and large, I think the change that we're going to see happen, and I hope happens, will come from financial incentives. The companies, including big companies, seeing that they can make money, they can make profits selling good, healthy, wholesome, delicious food.
And we leave it there. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Michael Moss, reporter and author of the book Salt, Sugar, Fat. He joined us to talk about some of the latest moves away from artificial ingredients in the food industry.
You can still share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. Is there an ingredient you avoid you'd like to see come out of the food that's available at the store, at the restaurant? Love to see your thoughts over there.